ourselves up. Mega thrusters are go.
Welcome back, Voltron fans, to part two of our two-part episode featuring our special guests, Harmony Gold creative director Tommy Yoon and artist Elmer Damaso. In the last episode, we had started reviewing the issues of the Robotech Voltron crossover comic series and had finished with issue number one. In this episode, we will finish reviewing issues 2, 3, 4, and 5. But first, Tommy, you wanted to make some shout-outs?
Yes. Thank you very much, Mark. I want to comment, you know, Elmer, he was indispensable in this project in terms of making all this fantastic artwork happen. But there was also quite a few people that were involved behind the scenes to help make this work. You know, first of all, there was Nick Barucci, the head of Dynamite, who actually chased us down and really pushed hard to make this crossover deal work. And so he deserves a lot of credit for this. And also over on the DC side, Hank Knowles and Sandy Resnick, who were able to help make this arrangement happen, to make this crossover happen. And then also in terms of the editorial team over at Dynamite, we also have Molly Mahan, the associate editor, who was most hands-on in terms of getting this book together, making sure everybody stayed on schedule. She deserves a lot of credit. She's actually moved on from Dynamite, but you know, we all wish her very well with her next work that she's also working on. Actually, it being a small world, she's at DC now. And then also senior editor Joseph Rybrandt, who was the senior editor on this project. Shout out to him as well. And also Jason Ullmeyer, who is the design director, who had to track down all these files and is also working on making this trade paperback happen. So, you know, want to make acknowledge them all for all their hard work in this project.
Okay, that's great. And of course, we want to pay homage to Carl Masick for bringing us Robotech to begin with.
Oh, right? Absolutely. And, you know, that's very important. Not just Carl, but also Peter Keefe, the original producer of the Voltron franchise. It's unfortunate that these two greats have, you know, unfortunately passed away. These gentlemen are the giants upon whose shoulders we are standing.
Great. Great, great, great. All right. Now, while we're giving shout-outs, I have to give a shout-out to Sony Pictures. How do you feel about this new 80s franchise they picked up?
You know, I cannot wait to see the next Ghostbusters movie.
Are you sure it's Ghostbusters?
Okay, all right. Well, you know, unless you've been under a rock, there has been some very good buzz about Sony picking up the Robotech live-action movie rights. And we're really excited about working with the folks over there. It's actually the producers of 300. This is Mark Canton and Gianni Nunari, who pushed hard to get this activity on Robotech moving full speed ahead. And they deserve a lot of credit for getting this whole deal fast-tracked into Sony Pictures. There's also Michael Gordon, who wrote the original 300, who co-wrote the 300 film, who is also working on development of this film. And we are just really grateful to work with these guys. They understand the importance of the franchise and its heritage with all the fans. And they take pride in their work, and they take this responsibility of adapting Robotech for the big screen very seriously. And we look forward to working with them on this.
So what was the reaction with you and the rest of the people at Harmony Gold when this happened?
Oh, we were very excited. Of course, you know, a lot of fans, they want the live action movie to happen yesterday. And of course, we'd like to see this happen as quick as possible. But we also want to make it with, we want to make the right movie too.
Right.
And we were very happy to see these folks with excellent filmmaking credentials approach us and find the right studio to move forward with this project with.
Right. Now, obviously, the Robotech fans are going to have to be a little bit patient here, okay, because it's still going to be a while, right, before something comes out.
It is, but I did notice there's definitely everybody involved is working very quickly to make sure that no momentum is lost in terms of making this live-action film happen.
That's great. That's great. Congratulations to you guys at Harmony Gold and everybody involved with the deal. We can't wait to see it.
Oh, I can't either.
All right, so what do you say we get back into these issues and start reviewing them again?
All right, fantastic.
Okay, cool. Going into the second issue here, and you start with actually a story that was based on one of the episodes from Voltron, the Love Bridge.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
And the story's being told from Lotor's mother.
Yes. We gave a name to Lotor's mother. We called her Laura. And this is where if you look in... watch the episodes carefully and you find out about the backstory of Lotor. He's got some mommy issues that you discover that his mother was not Drool, that she was in fact human and this beautiful blonde haired woman. And it kind of makes this creepy implication that because he has mommy issues over his late blonde mother, that that's why he has something for Allura. Okay, I'm not going to go any further into that. It's starting to creep me out too.
Okay, so why is she telling him a story about Eris?
So here I wanted to establish the loving relationship he had with his mother, that his mother was important to him. And so she's telling him like an old bedtime story about families that were far apart, and they were willing to build bridges across one another. And this is a metaphor for that. Here we have a human who... Here we have Lotor, who is a bridge between the Drool and the human worlds. He's part human, he's part Drool. He's halfway in between the worlds. And so his mother is hoping that, hey, maybe I can influence this kid to bridge, build a bridge between worlds, you know, for peace and unity. And so that's what she's hoping... to see in Lotor, that maybe he might not be quite like his father, who is this ruthless conqueror. And so she's trying to teach Lotor to be respectful of his heritage with Eris. So she's implying here that, oh, he's partly of Eris heritage as well as Drool heritage.
Right. Is there something else besides that?
Oh, yeah, and then the last comment from Lotor on this page, which his father never speaks of it in that way, and what does he say of it to you? Like all other planets, Eris is another domain to be conquered by the Drool Empire. So, you know, we've got the conflicting teachings of the parents. You know, mom says, oh, you know, peace and love and joy to all worlds and nations. Dad is like, let's conquer them all.
Right. And as they look up in the sky, they see the Omega comet.
Yes. So, you know, you see it little, you know, faintly in the sky. So, you know, they notice its presence, but they're unaware of the consequences it's going to have.
All right. So the ship is on the final approach to the Castle of Lions. There's a Drool delegation arriving at the same time as what they call a celestial omen. Karan is asking King Alphor, is there something you're not telling me? And he'll tell him in due time. And he actually says, there's much I'll have to ask of you as my royal counsel. And Karan basically says, whatever you wish.
So Alphor, at this point, Voltron, in this part of the story, Voltron is already missing.
Right.
And essentially, to kind of connect some of the puzzle pieces together, Voltron has already disappeared. The events of that backstory of the first episode where Voltron... has been met by the Dark Angel and has been broken up and hidden you know, around Eris has already happened. They're about to be betrayed by the Drools, and Alpha knows very well that this diplomatic negotiation that's about to happen is a sham, that it's not going to be a diplomatic negotiation. They're just going to be steamrolled. And so Alphor is basically knowing what his fate is going to be, and he's basically telling Coran that he's going to have him shoulder the responsibility of taking care of Laura after the events of today happen. This is like a very, very solemn scene for Alphor. Coran, on the other hand, is not quite aware of the gravity of the situation that's about to happen.
Right, and he's with his family, who are with Allura and the mice.
Yeah.
And he's saying it's time, and he needs to gather the staff and lead them through the passages to the Outer Towers. And he has to stay there with the princess. And she asks, but I thought they were coming to make peace with us. And he says, well, you know, we have to prepare for the worst just in case.
Yeah, so, you know, of course, Coran and Alphor are very well used to the fact that the Drool are not reliable in terms of their trustworthiness.
Right. So the Drools arrive.
Oh, yeah, and Ryza and Roland versus Garrett and Leto. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, you said you might change those names, right?
Yep. Yep.
Okay. All right, so arriving from the Drools is Laura and her son, Prince Lotor. And King Alphor says, so how does it feel to be a pawn? Man, just coming right out and saying it, huh?
Yeah, so this implies here that Laura is actually remotely related to Alphor. So here we're kind of establishing Lotor constantly has a thing for Allura because she resembles his mother. So here I'm making implication that this might be all one big family, that they might be related to one another.
The Drool soldiers, including Urak, are... Mm-hmm.
Who still has both of his eyes.
Right. He says, do you think they're on to us? And he says, they better not be. We've been warned of a powerful sorcerer hiding among the Erusians. Nobody really has an idea yet who this powerful sorcerer is. Then they introduce Allura, and then that's their sign as soon as she's introduced. And the comet is in position. And then Urak acts. He throws some rings towards Alphor. All of a sudden, there's this large ball and fireworks and electricity and everything, and out comes Hagar, who summoned me. And it's Urak acting on behalf of King Zarkon. And she says, do you realize what you've done? And she slashes him, and there goes his eyes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Alphor sees that the keys are hanging on a necklace around Hagar's neck, and he grabs them.
Yeah.
Now, does he use some kind of force to grab them? Because it looks like he used the force.
Yes. Okay, so we'll go from here. A lot of things are happening. In fact, oh my goodness, this scene has a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, the fans, when they saw the scene, oh my goodness, this is great. I wish we had twice the space to tell this story.
Yes. Yes.
You know, they're wondering, hey, there's somebody, you know, somebody like Hagar, someone powerful with magic hiding among the Erusians, and they don't know who it is. You know, but you find out, of course, soon that it's Alphor was the one who was powerful, you know, because Voltron has very mystical elements powering it. And so he was the man who has mastered Voltron.
Right.
And he understands how Voltron works. But at the same time, Voltron is also missing. So when Voltron previously went missing with the Omega Comet, not only were the lions missing, but the keys to activate the lions were also gone as well. So the Erusians were basically totally up a creek. But they had to find out what happened to the keys. And so here in this backstory, what's established, what is being implied here, you know, of course, we didn't have more backstory space to tell more, is that Hagar was actually hiding on the Omega Comet. So basically, not only was Voltron broken up and spread around Eris, the keys were out of the Erusians' grasp. Not, you know, even if you found the pieces of lions, you could never turn it on. You're basically up the creek. And so Alfor, knowing this, has timed this meeting to occur, you know, when they were, from the Drool point of view, they were using this to basically, they were thinking that they were going to give Alfor the shaft.
Uh-huh.
And Alfor was timing this so that he, you know, at this critical moment, could summon...
Hagar.
He would think, oh, those chuckleheads are going to think, you know, we're going to have this meeting occur while the Omega Comet's passing by when Hagar is there, and they're going to call them their dark sorceress and have her put the whoop-ass on me while I'm here and call out whoever the sorcerer is, and they're going to think they pulled a fast one on us. Whereas he, knowing that Hagar has the keys, when she is called when she is called forth by Urek, and you notice he's throwing rings similar to the magical rings that they use to steer the comet around in the Captain Comet episode.
Right.
And so, you know, this ring is kind of like a little homage to the magical rings that they use to control the comet.
Right.
And so here they call up Hagar, and when she first appears, she looks like, for a split second, a young woman under the robes. And the thing is, one of Hagar's hang-ups is that she's old and decrepit. She's using black magic to stay alive for how many centuries, who knows, but she's an old, decrepit woman now, and her big hang-up is she's not hot and beautiful anymore.
Right.
And so any chance she has to be beautiful, she tries to use it, you know, whether it's being an imposter or whatever, and she always laments the loss of her beauty. And so when she's on the Omega Comet, one of her wishes that's granted is, in her mind at least, she's always beautiful, young and beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she's taken away from the comet, her illusion goes away. And so she's like so angry at Urek, she takes one of his eyes away. And not only, you know, has that illusion that Hagar always wanted been taken away from her, she's been brought within the reach of Alfor. And so that is another consequence that Urek didn't realize he had done. He had played into Alfor's plan to bring Hagar within his reach so he could take the keys away from her.
Right. So I think the key thing here is that when we see her say, damn you, to Urek, we thought it was because she was being put within reach of Alfor, when it was really the fact that she was, you know, able to see the illusion of beauty there, and now she's back to her old ugly self.
Yeah, so it's two things. It's actually... So you have that really little subplot, you know, which... For casual fans, the fact that she's been brought back with the keys, that's enough for most fans. But for the fans who followed every single episode, oh my goodness, yeah, she's been taken away from her dream of everlasting beauty.
Right. So Alfor gets the keys. He says to Karan, take good care of my daughter for me. And just like that, poof. He
teleports them.
Yeah, they're gone.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, he's revealed himself as the Erusian Sorcerer.
Yeah.
And now, here comes a really cool thing. And how was this for you, Elmer, this whole scene where Alfor forms Blazing Sword in the throne room?
Well, actually, that was a bit of a challenge for me because even though it's a spread, I wanted it to look really grand. I wanted it to look really cool. So there's a couple of other panels around there. So I wanted to spread out the action in such a way that it's not distracting, and it should really just it should draw your eyes to Alfor forming the Blazing Sword. So actually, it was a bit of a I had to redraw this a couple of times before I was really satisfied with the layout. I really wanted the centerpiece of this spread to be Alfor, and I wanted the readers to really feel the power that was being generated inside the hall. So, yeah. But I was happy with the output so far. Yeah,
I mean, you get to see everybody's reaction to it. That are in that room all at once.
Yeah, you know? And that was a challenge, really.
Right.
I had to put a lot of stuff there aside from the main spread. I had to put a lot of other panels that led to that that centerpiece. So yeah, it was really a big challenge for me.
Right. In this one panel on the right, we see, I guess, is it Lotor that says who? Alfor is the sorcerer of Eris? And Hagar says, of course, who else besides me would know the key to the fate of the defender of the universe?
Yeah, so essentially here, these are the two powerful individuals with knowledge of magic who understands all the mechanism of what it would take to bring Voltron back into for the Eruusians. And so because he's the key to that knowledge, she realizes that Alfor is the one who is that great grand sorcerer, because he figured all this out on his own.
Right. And the last panel we see is a big explosion with Laura holding Lotor saying, watch out. What happens there?
Well, there was supposed to be a big attack that was progressing there, but just decided to cut it short there, segue from there, because it was just space.
Okay. So here we are back again a generation later, and we're looking at Lotor again, who's now King Lotor, and he's at the mural, and he wants them to bring Hagar to him. So we see that. That's a little quick, you know, segue. And then we go back to, on Earth, Iraq, Operation Desert Storm. This is a, you know, a big switch back to Earth here.
Yeah. Now, what's going on here is what you're realizing is that the memories of all these events are actually Lotor's memories. So he remembers all these events unfolding because he was there as a witness. You see the mural again. And so Lotor seeing this mural, this is what caused him to jog his memory and realize, oh yeah, Hagar was related, was tied to the events of the Omega Comet. And so he wants to bring in Hagar again because maybe she might know something, since the Omega Comet is returning yet again, to figure out how to get Allura back.
Okay, so who we see here is Pops and Tweety as the call signs for these guys?
Yes.
This is Dan?
That's right. Dan Fokker.
Dan Fokker.
Yeah.
Okay, and who's the other guy?
Pops Hunter.
Pops Hunter. Okay, yeah. So are these the fathers of Rick?
And... So this is the backstory for why Rick Hunter and his father has Roy Fokker in their family. And you never hear anything about Roy Fokker's father.
Right.
And so it's implied he was adopted into their family. And so the backstory here is that we took the name Dan Fokker. We took the inspiration from Dan Warren, who was the voice of Roy Fokker. And so we have Dan Fokker, whose call sign is Tweety. And you're wondering, where does Tweety come from? Well, Tweety was the nickname of his yellow biplane that Roy Fokker flew around in. So there's a little tie there for continuity nuts on the Robotech side. And Pops Hunter, that nickname was established from Robotech, the graphic novel, which established some of the backstory for the Robotech universe, originally written by Carl Masek back in the 80s. And so you discovered that they're co-pilots. And here in this operation over Iraq, only one of them end up surviving this mission, and it's Pops Hunter. And so after this tragic event, you see back at a military cemetery, the burial ceremony is being presided over by Admiral Hayes. And this is where Pops Hunter reveals to Roy that he made a pact with Roy Fokker's dad. They had a pact with one another, which was if anything happened to one of them, they'd watch over the other's children. And so Roy ends up being adopted into Rick Hunter's family.
Right, right. So he asks Rick to look over. He asks Roy to look over Rick like he's his own brother.
Yeah.
Okay. I got a question. On the ship that blows up, there's a skull and crossbones. What is that meant to represent?
This is the Jolly Roger squadron. This is a well-known squadron within the United U.S. Navy. This has the skull and crossbones symbol on the wing, and so this establishes for the reader, oh yeah, this is maybe the inspiration of why Roy Fokker ends up in a similar skull squadron unit within the Robotech Defense Force.
Okay, well, that's pretty cool. All right, so we go forward to 2014, and Roy is older. He's looking at the gravesite of his dad, and now also Pop Hunter has died too, right?
Yep.
He's being requested to go back to base. They go to Alaska base?
Yes.
What is the significance of Alaska base?
Well, I'll get to that in a second. Actually, okay. The significance is the tombstones.
Okay.
Is you look at the tombstones and you see that Pop Hunter has already passed away. It's been many years. And so Rick Hunter's father, who took care of Roy, has died of natural causes. And you see Roy's dad's tombstone, but then you see two other tombstones you don't expect to see. Claudia Grant to the left.
Yeah, we can't.
And Rick Hunter to the right.
We can't really tell that that's Claudia Grant unless you're really, you're really looking at.
Well, this is where you need to practice your crossword puzzles. You know, ends in a D-I, or watch more Wheel of Fortune.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, so the detail is in there. It's very small, but implies that even though they're in the Eris universe, from the Earth's point of view, because they don't know what the fate of the SDF-1 is, as far as they're concerned, they've been declared dead.
Right.
And also a little detail on the Richard Hunter tombstone is that cross with the funny-looking wings at the bottom. That's actually a similar symbol to what you see in Robotech the Sentinels when Rick Hunter marries Lisa Hayes. And so we just reuse that symbol from Robotech the Sentinels there on his tombstone. Whatever fictional religious affiliation that may be. And then Roy notices in the sky, hey, I've seen that before. So this foreshadows again that the Omega Comet is once again returning. So even though there's many different timelines going on, you know, past, present, future, what ties them all together is every time the Omega Comet appears, something hits the fan.
Right. Okay. So they're at Alaska base.
Yeah. So now Alaska base's significance is this is the hidden base used by Admiral Hayes to research all sorts of advanced robotechnology, including the Grand Canon. So there's this big reveal in Robotech where you see a giant beam of light blast out of Grand Canyon, a robotechnology weapon so powerful that it blows up a huge portion of the Zentradi fleet and in force of arms, but it's hidden deep in Alaska in the polar region. And so this is where Roy Fokker is coming. This is where they're doing advanced technology research on the Lions.
So Colonel Edwards, Roy Fokker, and who's the other guy?
Oh, we have Dr. Harry Penn, and he's a scientist from Robotech the Sentinels. And we've actually introduced him here because he's supposed to be a stand-in for Dr. Emma Lang, because Dr. Emma Lang has disappeared on the SDF-1 into the Eris universe where Voltron was.
Okay. All right, so they're worried about that comet.
Yes, they're worried about that again, but they're also, while they're investigating, you know, the events, the disappearance of the SDF-1 on Macross Island, you know, under everybody's nose, they've also been working on rebuilding the Alliance back into working order. And Edwards has a habit of hiding things from Roy Fokker, because even though they're supposed to be on the same side, the two have a very contentious, rivalrous, and almost adversarial relationship with one another.
All right, and what is Dr. Penn's relationship with Dr. Lang?
In Robotech the Sentinels, they're actually close associates. They're both research scientists who work closely with one another. For fans who are familiar with family ties in the Robotech universe, he's also the father of Karen Penn.
Oh, okay. So Roy's telling him that I lost just about everyone that mattered to me at Macross Island. Dr. Penn tells him that's not necessarily the case.
Yes.
So how must this sound to Roy, who thinks he's lost everyone, and now this guy's telling him that might not be the case?
Well, it'd be like telling somebody from, the Lost Universe, oh, well, maybe that plane didn't go down. Maybe it went into an island on an alternate universe. So, at first he's kind of, he's trying to wrap his head around it. It's a lot to absorb. It's just a crazy theory that these scientists are starting to unveil to him.
Right. So he's saying that, what if I told you the SDF-1 was not destroyed, but was torn out of our fabric of space and time in that flash of light you saw? And then Roy's like, well, if the space fold drive worked like it was supposed to, shouldn't we have heard back from them by now?
Yeah, even if they ended up somewhere like Pluto, which is right. What happened in the original Rubdeck series. They ended up at Pluto, and even though that was far away, they were able to make it back to Earth. But here, they were so far off in who knows where in the universe, that's why they haven't heard back from them yet.
Right. They're talking about the comet, and Roy remembers it as the one he saw years ago, but he thought it crashed on Macross Island.
Yes, he's actually conflating the events. He saw something crash on Macross Island, but it actually wasn't the comet. What he saw crash on Macross Island was actually one of the lions.
Right, right. All right, so now they're detecting all sort of irregularities with their instruments again. They call it the Omega Comet, and he wants to know who they is.
Oh, yeah, so they is, and how would they even have the name Omega Comet? See, the people on Eris might know what the Omega Comet, how would people on Earth know what the Omega Comet is? So this means that there's somebody from Eris that the scientists are hiding who know what the Omega Comet is.
Right, and he's talking about the young men that we recovered from the mecha that they found after the SDF-1 disappeared. And he's like, mecha? What mecha? And they say, all right, it's time to bring Roy up to speed on this.
Yeah.
And so they show him that they've been fixing up Black Lion, and they say it's not from Earth, it's alien.
Yeah, I mean, the SDF-1 is also alien, but, this is yet another alien technology,
right.
Besides even the SDF-1.
Right, and it's another potential energy resource besides protoculture.
Right, which is the crystals that operate within the lions, which you see a little detail about in the Captive Comet episodes. Of course, because this is another alternate alien technology discovered by the humans, this is something very valuable for them.
Right. So now we go to the far side of the moon. We find out Lord Chiron.
Yeah, Lord Chiron is actually he's similar to Lotor in that Lotor, even though he's supposed to be on the side of the rule, he'll often act like a spoiler. He'll sometimes mess things up because he'll do things for his own self-interests, which usually are he just wants to go after Allura. Chiron, on the other hand, somewhat similar character. He's this kind of pretty boy within the Zentradi ranks who's very ruthless, and he's nicknamed the Backstabber because he'll even betray his own side to get what he wants for his own self-interest. So he's like the most Lotor-like character among the Zentradi. And so even though he's supposed to have abandoned looking for the SDF on Earth because it's not there, he's still hanging out because he suspects there might be something else to the disappearance of the SDF-1. And behold, when he finds out about the lions there, he becomes interested in taking the lions for himself. And at the same time, this comet, he wants to find out more about what it's about. So we have Chiron still remaining within Earth space to create some havoc here from the Zentradi side.
Yeah, I have to say, when I was reading this, this was the part I had the hardest thing understanding what part Chiron played in the whole thing.
Oh, okay. So, are you, I guess, less familiar with the Robotech character lineup than within?
Yes.
Than
with, yes.
Okay. All right.
Yes, you should say that.
Okay. So here's what I noticed, which is really interesting, is when the Voltron fans read this crossover, right away, they know all the backstory motivations of all the Voltron characters. Say, oh my goodness, I understand this subplot. I understand that subplot. So you kind of understand, you know, all these really, really obscure subplots where all the robot Voltron characters are going. And likewise, you know, I wanted to make sure I had my nerd hat on the Robotech side, you know, so that all these little subplots on the Robotech side were also being introduced to satisfy the Robotech fans on the Robotech side. Whereas on the Robotech side, you know, they're a little bit more skeptical. Black Magic, what? You know, mixing it up with SDF-1, what? You know, because they're not as familiar with all these subplots from the Voltron side. So it's really interesting to see new things being discovered by fans of both sides. But at the same time, you know, once you get to understand all the story continuity from both sides of the universe, it's a lot of fun.
Right. Right. All right. So that's the end of this issue then. Go to issue 3. In a shadowy crypt, an ancient coffin waits to be discovered. There isn't a place because this is actually Keith's dream. Keith is having a dream while he's in a coma. So he sees an ancient coffin and he sees it's the princess Allura, and he says, no, it can't be. No! And he suddenly wakes up from his coma in the hospital on Macross Island.
Yes, yes. This is like the catacombs under the Castle Alliance when they go look for the keys originally. So this is Keith kind of like looking through the catacombs again. And what you're seeing here in a subconscious is his greatest fear, which is Allura is dead.
Right.
Because Keith here has been separated from Allura. And so this leads on to his regret again. You know, why didn't I profess my love to her while we had our last moments together, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, we'll get to that. But yeah, so this is a little bit of Keith's fears being explored right here.
So they're meeting for the first time after Keith wakes up on Macross Island on Earth in 2014. And Colonel Edwards wanted to be notified as soon as he woke up. So Colonel Edwards, Dr. Penn, and Roy are there. And they know who he is. They say his name is Keith Kogane. He wants to know how they knew, and he said, your men told us. We have your names, but not much else. And he asked the team, are they all right? And they're fine. The four of you, you had the worst injuries, and you've been in a coma for quite some time. And he says, four? But there were five of us. What about the princess? And he says, we haven't seen your princess. So far, we've only recovered the four of you.
Yeah, so when they say men, you know, obviously it's implying that they never found the woman, which is Allura, so she's still missing.
Yeah, and Roy says, hey, I know how you feel. I thought I had lost my fiancé in battle.
Mm-hmm.
But he's not giving up hope here. So they want to see if they can establish where they came from. And they say, you have a human anatomy, but there's trace elements in your blood they can identify. So they're wondering where that may be from. And he says, well, I've been on the planet Eris for many years. He says, this is Earth, but I believe the Earth, not the Earth you're familiar with. It may be a parallel Earth. So they tell him a story of several years ago, an extraterrestrial spaceship we named the SDF-1 crash landed on this world. We reverse engineered robot technology from the ship to create advanced fighting machines we call Mecha. So a little bit of backstory there.
Yeah, in the Voltron universe, I don't think they specify years quite as concretely as they do in the Robotech universe.
No, they don't.
And so because of that, I just kind of left the door a little bit open. You know, could it have been that he's on Earth, but he's on Earth from the future? Pidge implies that just a little bit when he talks about technology levels. Or is it possible that this might be a alternate Earth? So we kind of left that door open because Voltron is not as specific with dates, though, you know, kind of like Robotech, they say, oh, well, this is something that happens in the future.
Right. They had somehow been able to build some pretty remarkable machines from what they learned from SDF-1.
Yeah.
But did they, were they able to reverse engineer anything that they learned from Black Lion?
Yeah, so essentially, they, kind of like the SDF-1, they've mostly, to keep it consistent with that, they've mostly kept what they could put back together, you know, intact. You know, as Keith was the most injured and his Lion was the one in worse shape of the ones that they recovered, when they put it back together, it's the one that looks the most different than the other Lions.
Right. It's at this point you said, I don't understand. Do you think we're connected to SDF-1 somehow is what Keith asked. And he said, that's what we're trying to find out. And all we know is that you're part of this perfect storm of craziness. So they're admitting that there's a lot of weird stuff going on around.
Yeah, so now they're starting to put two and two together. Like, somebody's a fish out of water on one side.
Right.
And on the other side, somebody disappeared at the precise moment that these guys appeared. And so they're starting to figure out maybe the SDF-1 did disappear into a wormhole, you know, and get into this essentially a swap because of the events of the Omega Comet.
While they're meeting with him, another situation erupts where early warning satellites were shot down by incoming alien ships. They said that they're descending towards Macross Island. And then how much time do they have? About 9 minutes. So Roy is sent with Skull Squadron to put out the welcome mat. So they continue talking to Keith. They're asking him, did you lead them here? And he's like, I don't even know who they are. So they're still skeptical as to why he's there.
Yeah, so from the humans' point of view, you know, in the Robotech Earth, you know, they don't know who Keith is. They don't know much about the Zentradi. And so, you know, if they're not from this Earth, they must be all bad guys. So, you know, Edwards is the least trusting of them, who accuses Keith of this. Also, a little small detail here is the communication operators, the three girls that you see above in the big panel.
Yes.
They're actually the one in the foreground, Helena Chase. She's actually carried over from Robotech Battlecry, the video game. So for fans of that.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. All right. So as we see, it's actually Lord Chiron is maneuvering towards the planet, and now they know who it is. And but they're convinced that they call them the Micronians.
Yes, because the Zentradi are much larger than the humans, and so the Zentradi all refer to human beings as the Micronians.
Right, so they're convinced that they either have Zor's ship or knows where it is.
Yeah.
Okay, so back on Macross Island, we're in the room where the other Voltron pilots are being held.
Mm-hmm.
And we get to see Lance and Pidge and Hunk for the first time, and then Keith comes into the room, and they all get to have their reunion.
Yeah.
And so Keith asks Pidge for a status report, and Pidge starts to tell him about what they think has been happening here. Max is there as well.
Well, actually not. I thought this was really ingenious by Elmer, which was having a little flashback of Pidge talking about how he's been communicating with Max, trying to find out what's going on in the Robotech universe where they're in right now. And so he drew Max in as like this ghostly figure, as if that's where he was sitting when he was talking to Max earlier, though he's not there anymore right now.
Ah, okay.
So,
all right, that makes sense.
So that's a little clever visual trick he used there.
And, gotcha.
And Pidge here is a bit older, if you noticed.
Right, and even Keith mentions that. He seemed to have grown a bit.
Yeah, most characters, you know, after a small passage of time, they'll look about the same. But for anyone who has kids, you know, when you have children, you'll notice that even when kids are like, 8 years old, you see, you know, if you've got nephews or nieces, you don't see them for just a couple of months and you see them again. Holy moly, they already seem bigger. Do you notice this, Elmer?
Yeah.
So that was a little cue we put there, you know, so even his clothes didn't quite fit, so he's wearing slightly different clothes. And for fans, this is a little tiny visual cue for Southern Cross fans, you know, of other parts of Robotech. The military police who's guarding the quarantine is actually dressed up in the armor of the military police from the Southern Cross.
Okay, so based on the technologies of the time that Pidge is using, it looks like just like a tablet of some kind, and the internet that they have of the time. Looked back on trying to look at the history of everything and try to piece things together. After talking to Dr. Penn and things about the SDF-1, it's over 1,200 meters long and too advanced to be from around here. So who built it? They don't think the Alliance or the Drools have anything like it. Nobody knows it was found abandoned when it crashed here. So they think that whoever built it, it looks like somebody wants it in a big way. So that somebody is Lord Chiron, it looks like.
Yeah, so this is a mechanism for Voltron fans to get a little bit up to speed with the Robotech universe. So even though things up till now have been very mysterious, you know, fans are, well, what's going on here? What's going on here? We're kind of taking it from the point of view of the characters. You know, the characters themselves, you know, are bewildered by what has happened with the Omega Comet. And so we're kind of bringing the readers along for that sense of bewilderment. What the heck just happened here? And so we're learning along with the main characters. So from the Voltron character's point of view, they're learning what has been going on in the Robotech universe, which is this is the thing that has disappeared. The SDF-1 is the main element that has disappeared from the Robotech universe into the Voltron universe. And the ones who are after it that they're describing are the Zentradi.
Right. Pitch figures out that the comet is somehow responsible for the SDF-1 vanishing and us showing up here.
Yeah.
And Keith asks him, but how can the comet exist in both the past and the present? And Pitch says, there's a long explanation, but I won't bore you with the quantum physics right now. And he says, and it was heading right towards Eris.
The linear explanation, if the Voltron universe's version of Earth is, let's say, the same Earth as the Robotech universe, but centuries from now, then it could just be that the comet has just meandered around the universe, and because it's something that causes a tear into time-space continuum, things that disappear into the comet could appear anywhere where the comet is, but in a different time and space.
Right.
That's one explanation. And then the explanation number two, which is if, you know, it's just alternate Earths and the near-Earth future of the Robotech time is the same time as the near-Earth future of Voltron's time, then the comet transcends, you know, alternate realities. So because I wasn't sure, you know, because of the unclear, because the unspecified Voltron dates, you know, it could go either way. So that's why Pitch just leaves it open-ended for depending on what fans would want to believe.
Right. And then we go into the part where they show the backstory of King Alphor and him making his last stand against Zarkon and the Drools, but before making his last stand, he succeeded in taking back the keys of Ultron and hiding them away from Zarkon's reach. And it's nice that you have that one scene where the one mouse is holding the key while it looks upon the destruction of Alphor, basically.
Yeah. So this was actually, this is a really nice layout. A lot of the reference I had, I shared with Elmer, but you'll recognize that scene of Koran when they're making the escape from the Castle Alliance being burned to the ground. Essentially, the poor mice are seeing the same thing. This, I was hoping if we just have more space, we could have elaborated on this a little bit, is that the reason why one key was hidden in a different place than the other four was that Alphor kept one with him to power his magic when he was pulling out that blazing sword. Like I didn't know how to make it work in that space we had available, but that the blazing sword actually got pulled out of one of the keys. And then in the end, when he made his last stand so that the key would not be retrieved by the Drools, it's the mice that actually ran away with it.
Right.
But there just wasn't the space for that. So here we just kind of had it, the broad strokes of that truncated into this page here. Right. And it still works.
That works.
It's kind of hard to narrate everything in three panels.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, because one thing about comics is, you know, unfortunately, even though there's a zillion things you want to tell, with monthly comics, you're limited to 22 pages.
Right.
Yeah.
Zarkon is now ruling Arrhys in this stage of things. They're looking for the princess, no sign of the rest of the royal family, and he makes a decree to all the citizens there that you're my prisoners now. And for every day that the royal family remains at large, 10 of you will die. That is my will and decree. And then his wife, Laura, shows up. Well, Lotor's mother. I don't know. Are they really wife? And I don't know.
You know, if you're an emperor like Zarkon, do you really care?
Yeah, he doesn't care. Yeah. Obviously, he doesn't care. but she shows up and says, forgive me, I have a matter that's too urgent, couldn't wait. And he says, what is it? And she says, your strategy to find the royal family, it's wrong. No, it's more than wrong. It's wasteful. Even if you succeeded, you'll create generations of opposition. And he says, well, you know, maybe you're right, but maybe one death will be enough to make a point. And then he kills her. Just kills her right then and there.
So essentially, he wants to frighten the people of Arrhys that if he's willing to kill someone this close to him for just defying him just the tiniest bit, even respectfully, you know, how much they should fear him. And so he's illustrating how ruthless he is. But then at the same time, what she says rings true, which is the resentment and resistance he ends up creating in Lotor. So you notice how in the series, Lotor can't wait to basically, stab his father in the back. You know, he has no relationship with his father, you know, as far as he's concerned, if you watch the series. And so here we're establishing, and also you do see a scene, there's a flashback scene where Lotor sees Zarkon choking his blonde mother in the series. And so here we elaborate on that, tying into that.
So Lotor sees his mother get killed by Zarkon right in front of him. A generation later, we're back to where Lotor is king, and he's at the mural, and he had summoned Hagar. Hagar appears, and they're talking about the Omega Comet. He wonders what had happened to them, and you know, he says, this mural is obviously dedicated in the memory of Allura and the pilots. Hagar said that the comet transcends the space-time continuum, causing anomalies and distortions in its wake, and like sending someone to another world or universe. And Hagar says she's seen it for herself, and he says, can the effects of the comet be stopped? And she says, no, but it's a door that opens both ways to the path of the subject's choosing. So he wants to know how to find it, and she says, I have that magic at my disposal to do just that. And he says, prepare it, we're going to change history. But she says, but beware, your search for the princess may run the risk of the return of Voltron. So it appears he's okay with that.
Yeah, so, you know, just like the Drools wanting to grab Hagar back, also brought back Voltron, you know, basically your risk runs both ways when you play with the events of the Omega Comet.
And we see somebody watching the witch from afar in this scene. Who is that?
Oh, that's Sven.
Yeah, what's Sven doing
in
there?
Sven is always like this character who's part of the underground and the resistance. Actually, if we had unlimited space because Romel was thrown into that deep, dark pit and she runs into Sven there and, you know, you find Sven. And I wanted to do something with that scene because it cracked me up so much. Hey, I've been living underground here, living on mushrooms and whatever. And, you know, that scene was such a crack up. I would have loved to have done something with that. But again, you know, space. So we just had Sven here acting as part of the resistance in this stage of the Arrhys universe without Voltron. This shows that, you know, because Lotor is aware of the comet's return and he's consulting and summoning Hagar once again, the citizens of Arrhys also become aware of this as well. And they make their own preparations as well. And they start to put all these clues together, you know, with all these things that have happened on Eris.
All right, so then we go back to Macross Island, and Skull Squadron is trying to protect them from the attack of Lord Chiron's fleet. Can you tell me what happens during this battle?
Oh, yeah, just simply that Keith has broken out of his house arrest, and he's commandeered the lion, and he's helped him. So this reassures our characters from the Robotech Defense Force that he is on the good guy's side.
Okay. All right. And then we go back to Aris, and Hagar is conjuring to try to get control of the comet.
Yes. So once again, you see the rings of the comet trying to influence the path of the comet. And Hagar is once again going to use magic to use the comets to her advantage.
All right, so the Omega Comet is entering the Aris system. King Lotor, I guess, is back now. They say there's something wrong. There's another energy pulse coming from the planet. I think it's a temporal distortion. And then they say, what in the name of drool is that? And it's the SDF-1, right?
Yes.
All right, so Lotor basically tells them to take it out of the sky. Secondary systems are powering back up on their own. I think the SDF-1 is going to defend itself again.
Yes, this is just a small cue from the booby trap episode. Until the humans, you know, master control of the SDF-1, when the SDF-1 is under attack in some of the early episodes, the SDF-1 would actually take command of itself and actually defend itself. So the main guns, when it senses the Zentradi fleet approaching, actually launches without human control. And so until they finally get hang of the control of the SDF-1, it almost acts like a large living creature.
Okay, so it says they're gone, sir. The beam got them all. And we see from Sven's perspective on the planet, they say, what is it, Sven? What's wrong? It's an energy beam of some sort, a big one. I'm afraid the war is returning to Aris.
Yeah, so like how the last arrival of the Omega Comet a generation earlier had taken away Voltron and brought all this conflict upon Aris. Now it's returning, and it's going to bring conflict again. But what's interesting here is on Aris, the time at which Voltron disappeared with one passage of the Omega Comet is not the same time at which the SDF-1 appeared. So here, we notice that there's a passage of time. The SDF-1 actually appears when the Omega Comet comes back again.
All right, so we move into issue 4 now. King Lotor asks Hagar, what happened? Can you sense anything? And Hagar says the battle's already over. All your ships have been lost, not by the Omega Comet, but by something that brought here from another time and place. And he's saying, are they something that was destroyed from something in the future? And she goes, not the future, the past. A powerful ancient fire rekindled by human minds. But it's a fire that may consume them. So what does that really mean, that the SDF-1 may consume them?
Oh, this if you're into Robotech continuity, the SDF-1 is actually an older battleship. It was a battleship used by Zor, controlled by the Robotech Masters, before it fell into human hands. And so because Robotechnology and the Robotech Masters are actually very old, you know, she senses that this Robotechnology on the SDF-1, even though it's like a futuristic ship, is actually a very old technology that has come into their universe that normally doesn't interact with their universe. And so that's why she talks about the past. And also the past being that in the Robotech universe, the SDF-1's events that we saw earlier on Macross Island occurred in 2009, which is now our past.
Right. Okay, so Claudia asks, is there any sign of Roy's Veritech? And not so far, but she wonders, are these the same aliens who attacked us on Macross Island? Before they do anything else, they need to figure out where, and then he gets interrupted. I see a reading in Sector 6. It's an undamaged ship, but it's not one of the attackers, and it's definitely not a Veritech, and it's the Mockingbird.
Yeah, so Claudia recognizes that plane as being Roy Fokker's plane, and that Rick Hunter inherited. And so it is the stunt plane mm-hmm. that Rick Hunter uses in the Booby Trap episode of Robotech. And so she recognizes it as the plane that would have Rick Hunter on it. This actually mirrors the events of the Spacefold episode. In the Spacefold episode, when the SDF-1 emerges out of a Spacefold, it's in an unfamiliar part of space, but they actually went to Pluto. Here, they ended up at Eris, and instead of taking the aircraft carriers Prometheus and Daedalus with them, they took Armor 1 and 2. And so here, you know, some of the events have been changed up. And here they're also still, because it occurs early in the Robotech timeline, they're still unfamiliar with the Zentradi. So whether it's the Zentradi or the Drool, they're not sure.
So now they thought maybe if it was caught in a fold, maybe that could actually be Rick Hunter.
Oh, yeah. So essentially, Rick Hunter has been taken with them, because that actually happens in the early Robotech episodes. So Rick actually did get caught up in the space fold with them.
Okay, so Claudia sees Rick in, I guess, in the hospital?
Yeah.
What is she confronting him with?
Well, she wants to know what he knows as well, because she knows Roy is Rick's adoptive older brother. And so because of that, she knows about Rick. And at the same time, he had been invited over to Macross Island to observe the launch of the SDF-1 before all hell broke loose. And so she wants to find out.
She wants to know what he was trying to prove out there, that he was going to get himself killed, because how long did he think he was going to survive in that fan jet?
The subplot here is, if you watch the Spacefold episode of Robotech, the reason why he's actually in hot water is he wasn't supposed to leave the SDF-1.
And he took Minmay with him?
Yes. The reason why he ends up outside of the ship during the Spacefold in the original Robotech episode is that as the SDF-1 was taking off from Earth and it was about to do the Spacefold, Minmay wanted to go back down to Earth.
Right.
And so Rick actually stuffed her in his little plane with him, and they took off from the SDF-1 while it was taking off from Earth, about to go into Spacefold.
Yeah, he didn't think it was that far up yet.
Yeah, and Rick was, because he was just this cocky little kid with a lot of flying skills, he just thought, what the hell, I'll take her with me, even though he was flying into the midst of danger. You know what, this was a case where it was kind of a tough call. I wanted to actually put more backstory in there, and there wasn't space for it. But at the same time, if I left this out, then, you know, how is Rick on the SDF-1? So we needed to introduce Rick onto the SDF-1, but at the same time, for, you know, how crazy with continuity fans are with the little events that occur in these episodes, make sure at least it links up with the episode. So this is why Rick starts out in hot water when we first see him in this issue right here.
Okay. So then we return to Macross Island on Earth. They're still involved in the battle. Scout ship was irreparably damaged and crashed into the sea the south of the island's harbor, but the impact masked the launch of their gravity mines, and the Microdians did not see our next attack coming. What happens in this is some of the lions are actually fighting there, too.
Mm-hmm.
What happens as a result of this?
Okay, so here, now we... By this point, the Lion Force pilots are fighting alongside the Robotech Defense Force pilots on Macross Island.
Right.
Little nice visual cue here drawn by Elmer is that the gravity mines used by the Zentradi around Macross Island resemble the anti-gravity drives used aboard the SDF-1. You'll notice that that aircraft carrier Mark 101, that's Prometheus there.
Right.
But here essentially what we're doing is we're introducing that by this point, the Lion Force and the Robotech Defense Force, they're fighting side by side. And Chiron witnesses this. And as Chiron has seen this technology from Eris, he wants to take it for himself.
Right. Then we come to the United Earth Government's Alaska base again. And we're back with Keith. All right, so what's happening here with Keith and the others?
Basically, Edwards is letting them know why he's quarantining them back at Alaska base, because Keith and the lion originally crashed on Macross Island, but Edwards is holding them in quarantine in Alaska, which is also where the lion technology is being kept, because he doesn't trust them, but at the same time also Edwards wants to control this technology as much as possible.
He wants to take control of the lions for himself?
Yeah, essentially. Because you'll find out later in the Robotech Universe series that he actually goes from being supposedly one of the contentious protagonists to becoming an antagonist later.
Ah, okay. So
to make it consistent with his character here, already even Dr. Harry Penn here is sharing information with Keith because he doesn't trust Colonel Edwards.
Why is there's this one panel where it shows the Alaska base. Why is it in the form of a circle?
Ah, the Alaska base is arranged in a giant circle. And you'll see this in actually some of the shots of Robotech. The reason why is underneath that circle is where the Grand Canyon is hidden.
Oh.
So there's a giant canyon that's miles deep hidden there because nobody wants their building to be underneath the canyon itself.
Gotcha. That was what was strange to me. Okay. He's still he wants to find out whether Princess Allura is still alive. And Pitch comes and finds him and says, I think I have a good idea where she might be. The other question is will Colonel Edwards let them search for her? He detected an energy signature emanating from the remote part of Egypt. Looks like the pyramids of Giza.
Yep.
It looks like they might get to go after if they get permission from Edwards. All right, so in the meantime, we're on the SDF-1 again. We're back with Claudia. They're talking about Rick. Doctors cleared him. And does he know about Commander Foker? And she told him yes.
Oh, so this is also a contrast in disappearance, which is from Roy's point of view, the SDF-1 has been missing for years. And so at that point in his timeline, he's resigned that everybody has perished. Whereas from the SDF-1's point of view, we're witnessing, because they've traveled instantly over space and time, this disappearance, from as far as they're concerned, is all fresh. And so they know that they're missing, and they don't have this sense of resignation quite yet because everybody just went missing because the events of the Omega Comet just happened. And so they're still trying to piece together what's happened. So they're a little bit more proactive in terms of trying to piece together the events at this point.
All right. So they're at this point, they're close to Eris.
Yes.
So they're thinking that maybe Eris was the intended target.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, all right. So they're going to go down and check it out.
Yeah. So intended target, meaning that when the Drool attacked them, they actually didn't mean to attack the SDF-1. They were actually supposed to be attacking Eris, and the SDF-1 was just an unexpected party that just arrived.
Right. So down on Eris, Karan welcomes them and says that we led you to our refuge because we saw your actions against the Drool, so they thought they might be friends. And then they introduce themselves, you know, as the commanding officer of the SDF-1. We come from a planet called Earth. And he says, are you from the Galaxy Alliance? And he's like, no, what do you know about Earth? And then Sven comes on and says, I'm from Earth too, but I've never seen a ship like yours before. Are you here to liberate Eris? And he says, we don't even know what we're doing here. So they were just going to... Seems like they have a lot to discuss, so they were going to land there.
Mm-hmm.
They're back on Alaska base again. He's talking about taking the lions around the world on a wild goose chase to find Allura. They've got a lead for the fifth lion, and it looks like they're going to get some help one of the guys there is going to help them go get it. Right?
Yeah.
All right, so they get the permission to go. We're back on Eris. They're having a meeting with the crew of the SDF-1. But before that, there's some backstory talk between Dr. Lang and the captain.
Yeah, so this is a dual purpose scene, which is from like earlier where we had the Eris characters on Macross Island, Pidge talking about all the things that he discovered. This was a way for both the characters come to up to speed with what's going on in the Robotech universe, and also for Voltron readers who are unfamiliar with Robotech to get up to speed with the backstory of Robotech. Here we have likewise vice versa, which is the characters on board the SDF-1 who have come onto Eris are getting up to speed about the Eris universe, you know, the Voltron universe. And so this is a way for Robotech fans also to get up to speed and learn a little bit about the Voltron universe as well. And here we have a little tie-in showing how there is also an Earth in their system, and you see a little homage to Vehicle Voltron in there. And that they also use a alien power source, except instead of using protoculture like the characters on the Robotech side use, they use the crystalline energy source on their mecha.
Right. At the end of this, we see Hagar looking in on them and says, "Ha! By contacting these outsiders, that fool Karan has finally given away the secret hiding place of the Castle of Lions." So we get back on Earth, and they've got Rick Hunter's ship, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Black Lion.
Oh, no, that's actually not that's Rick Edwards. Hunter there. That's Edwards.
Oh, I'm sorry. That's Edwards.
Yeah, that's Colonel Edwards escorting them.
Gotcha. Okay. What is happening here?
He actually turns on them.
Why does he do that?
He's actually the master of betrayal in the Robotech universe. So his motivation is that he finds that because the positive characters are starting to coalesce around one another. Like you notice, Roy Fokker reaches out to Keith, and they kind of have a meeting of the minds, and also Dr. Penn, who's also a positive character. They all have a like mind that they're all good-hearted protagonists, and they're starting to work together. And Edwards doesn't like this because he's actually the adversarial protagonist who eventually becomes a villain in the Robotech universe. And so his plot is that he's going to make it look like they tried to pull a stunt and he had to shoot them down, and there won't be any Voltron pilots left to be in the way of him just basically taking the technology for himself.
Yeah. Okay. In the battle, Roy shows up, right?
Yeah.
And he basically takes out the ship.
He basically takes care of Edwards for them. And because they have this kind of rivalry and pride between them, he knows that Edwards isn't going to report it, you know, because he would never want to admit that Roy bested him at anything.
Right. So they're on their way to find the princess.
Yep.
So now we're back on Eris again. Claudia said they'll be launching again in a few hours. They think they found a way back to Earth. Now we're back to Rick Hunter. He's next to his plane. And all of a sudden he sees King Alphor.
Yeah.
And King Alphor tells him, "You have the heart of a lion, even if you don't realize it yet. I am Alphor, I once ruled these lands, and your predicament is indirectly born of actions I took a generation ago. I can help you and your friends, I can help you lead them home." And he says, I do know you, Rick Hunter, perhaps better than you know yourself. So King Alphor is now talking to Rick, and he's going to help him get things back the way they should be.
Yeah, so because all the lions and their pilots are missing from the Eris universe, Alphor senses that there's a very talented pilot among the humans, and he senses this in Rick Hunter. Rick Hunter, who eventually becomes Admiral Rick Hunter of the Robotech Expeditionary Force. And so he actually appears to him in this vision to come and help out. Now, originally, I think in the original, in the original draft of the storyline, he was actually going to carry, with the knowledge that Alford gives him. He was going to carry out some of the events of the last issue in his fan jet, the Mockingbird, the plane, the little plane you see there. But then there was this insistence, hey, wouldn't it be great to see Rick Hunter and a lion, but all the lions are on Macross Island somewhere else. So this is where Bill Spangler and I had introduced the subplot of the additional lion, the sixth lion, which is the white one. And so we kind of took them from the Harry Potter term you used earlier, King Alphorus, quote-unquote, Patronus, the white lion. And so we used that to be the inspiration of this sixth lion, which may have been the lion that Alphor himself used at one point, hidden in the polar region.
Okay.
Yeah, actually, in the first draft I made, I wasn't familiar with the white lion. I drew a real lion there. Tommy had to correct me there, and I said, no, it's another robotic lion, so I had to change it.
Right.
That was actually funny, but yeah, that was because that part of the story was being rewritten kind of a little bit on the fly. But you notice that he flies off in his fanjet, and actually he originally scripted he was going to fly the fanjet until the end of the story, but we added in the white lion. And yeah, you do notice him following Alphor's Patronus to the polar region, to the hidden pyramid in the snow.
So we're on Arras in the far universe, and we're at the STF-1, and we see Minmay for the first time in issue 5. And she's talking to Claudia. Claudia wants to know what's going on. Minmay doesn't really know. She thinks everything is suspicious, that Rick and the whole thing with his ship and everything. And Minmay tells her he's no spy, you know. He did act funny and kept mumbling about flying north. And she's like, yeah, like Santa Claus. Like, he was serious, like he had seen a ghost.
You'll see that the way she speaks might seem a little bit naive, like a young girl would speak. And that was on purpose, you know, because of her age, you know, because she hasn't even turned 16 yet. She's a little bit bewildered by her surroundings. We kind of copied her speaking style from the Robotech episodes to, you know, have the little Santa Claus metaphor in there. In terms of the storyline, Minmay didn't have a lot to do in this story because it occurred so early in the Robotech continuity. In terms of the characters on the SDF-1, she hadn't been introduced much yet. But since she had been on board Rick with him on the plane, we thought this was a perfect use of her character right here, just to explain where Rick had gone for the rest of the issue.
Okay. Well, we're back on Earth again, and this time Keith and Black Lion and Colonel Edwards are looking for Alora, and they find her in a crater, and she doesn't remember anything, and she doesn't even remember, you know, much about what's going on. She says, the doctors here rescued me from a terrible explosion. They've been taking care of me, but I don't remember much. I sensed someone was coming for me, and that somehow this is important. She's talking about the key that's around her neck. They tell him, we've got company, we got to get airborne again, and all of a sudden the scene changes. So now we're back to the SDF-1, and then they see something that is really strange. They see space coffins.
Mm-hmm.
They see that they're partly organic, and they're heading straight for us. And they activate defensive countermeasures, but the one space coffin lands on the ship, and then all of a sudden it turns into a Robeast.
Yes.
What's going on here?
All right, so to go back to the pyramid episode, they're going to where Alora is. You know what? There's one little small detail that was missing here, and I'll see if we can shoehorn it into the graphic novel, or the trade paperback compilation is... There was an episode in Voltron in which Keith has a nightmare sequence in which he has a nightmare of running through a forest, and then he sees Allura, and he sees multiple visions of Allura, and he finds out who the right one is because he can see a blue glow from her. And okay. So this was something I was hoping was going to be put into the scene, and we'll see if we can make it work, but just through coloring alone. But that was just a small cue from that they can sense. There's almost like something like a Luke and Leia sensing the Force
exactly.
among one another, that this is what helps Keith find Allura so quickly.
Right.
Now,
I get that.
Yeah. So now here from the SDF-1 senior is describing, this is like the sense of Bill Wilderman that they would be seeing, like some of the Robotech fans going, oh, how can you make this crossover happen? Because, you know, the SDF-1 is scientific and technological, and the Voltron universe is full of black magic. How do you make that work? And, from my point of view, I'm like, wow, that's an opportunity. What if, you know, the SDF-1 on this high-tech, you know, battle fortress sees a bunch of space coffins, you know, crash on board, not robots coming out, but, you know, these giant monsters, you know.
Right.
And so this is like, and not only that, there's also a difference of scale. Like, oh, the SDF-1's just way too big. You know, wouldn't it just step on the Robies? So the scenario we put in here is that the Robies are actually busting up the SDF-1 from within.
Right. And they think Haggar thinks it's only a matter of time before that ship is ours, and yeah. The Omega Comet will enable us to conquer their world as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so Keith is trying to get the princess out of there really quick because they're getting attacked.
Mm-hmm.
She says, no, I can't go, but we're under attack. Then she says, but I remember now. I can't leave it here. Leave what here? And then all of a sudden they realize, obviously, it's her lion.
Yeah. So her lion is still buried underneath the sand.
Right. Right. Who's in there? And she gets into it and she sees her father. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And obviously she doesn't recognize him again. But then she says, I'm not a warrior. And he says, your self-worth comes not from your title, but from your deeds and actions. The way your own mother once found me, what does that mean?
You know what? That was the blue glow thing. This was going to be a really subtle thing. You know, you have the blue glow. Allura sees it in him. He sees it in her. And so it was like a magical kinship that they had with one another. And so that's how they found one another. That's how she sees Keith. And she snaps out of it.
Yeah, she sees, I see the man I love.
Yeah.
And she knows now what she has to do.
Yeah.
So she puts on her helmet and she's ready to go.
And, you know, all while Chiron, the most unpredictable Zentradi, wants to take the lions for himself. So, you know, it's like, you know, no matter who in the Robotech universe, everybody wants the lions.
Right. So now that we're back on the SDF-1, it's getting attacked by Robeasts. They're trying to attack us from within. They try to contact Karan back on Eris. Maybe they know how to deal with these Robeasts. And they want to evacuate Sector E-21 and prepare to open the emergency seal. Have Captain Kramer send in a Veritech fighter to try flushing out one of the bogeys. And then there's a transmission from the Castle of Lions. It's Karan. And I said, I must warn you about the Robies. These are creations of black magic by the Drool. Unfortunately, our best weapon against them had been the Lion Force. And they say, black magic. Oh, that's a new one.
Yeah.
So they're saying that they have robo-technology designed to battle the giant Zentradi, and sufficiently advanced technology should be indistinguishable from magic.
This is actually like a little nod to, you know, some of the fans' comments that, you know, how do you have hard sci-fi and something that's a little bit more fantasy mixed with one another, and that is how our characters are reacting here.
Right, So Karan sends up the Castle of Lions to help.
Yes, and so here we have a view of the Castle of Lions actually launching in its ship form, which you see in one of the latter episodes of Go Lion.
Mm-hmm.
It's mid-transforming this last panel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Captain, we've got another identified approaching the ship. What is it, one of those monsters? No, sir, I think it's something else entirely. And that's where they see the, is that the white line or the silver line?
That's the white line.
Oh, yeah, that's the white line.
The white line.
So I'm guessing when you make the reference to silver, the white and silver line are the one and the same.
Right. All right. Okay, so then they go back to Earth. It's Keith. He says, can I get some help from Roy? Because he's not able to get to Black Lion. And Alora comes in with Blue Lion. What happens here?
So what happened is Keith was about to be stranded because the Zentradi were about to make off with this Black Lion. But then you'll see the outline of the Blue Lion emerging from the sand because that's where Alora ran into under the ground.
Right.
And so it actually fires at the Zentradi, and then his Black Lion falls back to the ground.
Okay, so then the other lions show up. Somebody call for help. It's Pidge, Lance, and Hunk. And they say that Max and Dr. Penn helped them escape. They heard about the attack, and they came as quick as they could. So now they're helping to even the odds. And now Keith gets back in Black Lion. He says, I was beginning to wonder if I would ever say this again, but ready to form Voltron.
Right.
So now we're forming Voltron, which is really cool.
So all of them are nice and shiny, except the blue one has some marks. You know, it's still a little bit busted up. But other than that, you know, now they finally have all the five back together again.
Right. So they form Voltron. They form Blazing Sword. And Hagar can't believe it, that Voltron has formed again. So back on the SDF-1.
Yeah, now she does say specifically, you know, Voltron has formed again. She senses Voltron has formed, even though it's not in her universe.
Right. Okay, so now the White Line is helping the SDF-1. And they say to the White Line, are you from Arrus? And White Line says, well, yes and no, the Mecha is from Arrus, but you've got Rick Hunter at the controls. So it's Rick in the White Line.
Yes.
So he says, I was sent north to find this Kimba, which I was told could help us back to Earth. I wish I could say more, but I don't think you'd believe the ghost story. And they say, well, we're ready to believe a lot of things.
Yeah.
So they talk about the comet is close by again, and they wonder if they're ready to activate the space fold.
Yeah. But then, you know, they have one last wrinkle, which is Hagar wants to keep Voltron out of their own universe as much as possible. And so you have a Robeast actually smashing around down in the depths of the SDF-1 where Dr. Lang is trying to initiate the space fold.
Right, and they could only do a partial transformation.
Yep.
And Captain says, just do it.
Yeah.
So we're back to where Voltron is.
Mm-hmm.
And Colonel Edwards says, I'm going to have to ask Dr. Penn if we can reverse engineer that contraption. He's talking about Voltron.
Yeah.
And the Omega Comet is coming back. This is all starting to come together in a big, big thing that's going to happen.
Yeah.
They see that the rings are the thing that must be controlling it. So yep. We'd need to disrupt all those without getting trapped.
Mm-hmm.
And Pitch says, I've got something we didn't use last time. And then here we go. He's forming Blazing Bow, and he fires it. And then all of a sudden, the partial transformation is complete. They execute a hyperspace fold jump, and everything happens on this one two-page panel here.
Yeah.
Where we see in the one corner, we see Voltron. This is really strange. We see Voltron, Vehicle Voltron, and Albagos Voltron?
If you used to collect the Matchbox toys, I think they called it Gladiator.
Gladiator Voltron. Right.
Of the Biddle universe.
Yeah. And then we see in the middle is the comet. And at the top we see, is that Laura?
Yeah, with Lotor.
Right.
You can see his clothing at least.
Right. And then on the top right we see all the individual lions and Colonel Edwards' ship. We see, is it King Lotor or Prince Lotor on the right?
Yeah, Prince Lotor in cahoots with Chiron.
Right. And then on the bottom, we see, what, Minmay
And Min Mei and the princess.
And the princess. Yes. And then the bottom we see the four pilots.
With Max as one of the pilots.
Right, with Max. Okay. And then in the bottom left we see Robis.
Yeah, and Britai. Yeah, that's the Zentradi commander.
Okay.
Britai. Yeah.
So he's actually the largest of the he's one of the largest of the Zentradi. So he's basically so big he stands he can stand next to basically beat up a Robeast.
And we see the SDF-1.
Yeah.
And then the far right panel is just it looks like everything's disappearing.
Yeah, so yeah. What's happening here is in the previous page before the big mashup that we have in the double spread, you see the Dark Angel once again trying to tempt Roy, saying, hey, you know, just hang out with me a little and I'll make your dreams come true. And he's like, ah, what the hell, just go away. I want my universe to back the way it was, you know.
Right.
Paraphrasing there. And so he attacks it at the same time that the Voltron Force released the blazing bow, the arrow at it.
I think this spread is a collage of all the possible realities that may have happened if, you know, we mixed and matched the two worlds together.
Wow, that's really cool. On the last few pages here, Keith asked the Voltron Force to sound off. Is everyone all right? They're doing great. We're doing better than great. They're home, right? And then Lance says, I still feel like we ran away from a fight. But, you know, it's...
Yeah, well, that kind of goes along with this character. You notice that he's always the jumpy, punchy one.
Yeah, but Keith reminds him, well, now that we're back in our own system, I have a feeling we're going to be dealing with Robeasts again. So, any sign of the Omega comet? Keith says Princess, but Princess says, Keith, it's okay if you just call me Allura. And no, it dematerialized completely, but wait, I thought I saw something else, but it's gone now. Was that the White Lion?
Yeah, so it's like the White Lion, Rick is not in it anymore, and it's like going back to where it's supposed to be hidden again.
Right.
And so it's like just a fleeting glimpse.
So now we're back to Lotor after the flash happens, and he's like, what happened? And the guy says, we're not sure, Prince Lotor. And he said, what did you call me? Prince Lotor. King Zarkon sent a message demanding to know what you intend to do about the five lions. And he says, they're all back? And he says to Hagar, what's the meaning of this? That we've experienced a taste of the worlds that may have been, but alas, the Omega Comet is past. So if Voltron is back, then Allura is back, but remains out of my reach. And at the end, his last comment, that said, I must find out more about this planet Earth. I thought that was an interesting tidbit there.
Yeah, so what's happened is, you know, as the Omega Comet passes, they still have a shadow of the memory of what has just passed. But, you know, everything's starting to get fuzzy as the universe settles back to where they've been.
Right.
And so likewise, same happens with the Robotech characters in the last page.
Yeah, so on the Robotech last page, we have permission to come aboard the bridge, Captain. And he says, granted, Lieutenant Commander, do you have a progress report for me? And it's Roy. Reconstruction of Macross City is underway inside the SDF-1, and we should have most of the refugees settled in before we make flyby of Saturn. And Claudia's like, Roy? And he says, Claudia, you look like we've been worlds apart. And then some construction workers found a pair of kids with the wreckage of a fan jet in the lower levels of SDF-1. That must be Rick.
Yeah, that's Rick and Min Mei, supposedly.
Right.
Supposedly. Yeah.
So this is a scene that you don't really see. This is like a scene that you don't really see in Robotech. At the end of the long wait, Rick is recovered when workers accidentally find him hidden in the bottom of the ship. And then Roy comes to his aid. So this is like the flip scene in which you see Roy's point of view when they discovered that they found him after he had been missing some time.
Right.
And so as far as this Roy is concerned, you know, when you see him showing up, it's a, you know, the universe has been put back together, but Claudia still has a shadow of the memory of what had occurred earlier. And so she's kind of hoping for like, you know, a romantic conclusion at the end, but Roy just jumps off like crazy and she's just like, ah, you know?
Right. So we're finally at the end.
So we're at the end, and you see, Sammy making the last remark, Captain No Smoking on the Bridge, which is like one of those quips that she would always throw at Captain Global when he pulls out his pipe.
Right.
And so we notice that, you know, just like many crossovers, you know, the universe has been put back together and made whole the way it was before.
Right.
You know, the one difference is that over the course of the story, we've learned a lot about all of the characters involved. We know more about Prince Lotor's backstory, more about Rick, Roy and Rick's backstory. So that was, in spite of the tight space that we had, I was really happy to do all that backstory exploration about those characters. And I am so grateful to have had this chance to work with Elmer.
Well, I have to tell you, you both did a terrific job. And, even though it was only 5 issues and everything, it felt like a longer story as we went over it.
I hope it came across as a service to, you know, both Robotech and Voltron fans, that the story was so dense. You know, it's better than the vice versa, where you have a comic series with nothing to say, whereas here we just had so much to say in the space that we had. And hopefully in the trade paperback compilation, we'll include some of the notes of, you know, these other ideas, some of the stuff that we're even discussing here.
Right. And that's the nice thing about this review of all 5 issues is that people can now getting an inside understanding of what you guys were thinking about when you were making this.
Yeah.
So I really appreciate you guys coming with me on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast. And I just want to give you a chance real quick. Is there any events coming up for the Robotech 30th anniversary that you guys want to plug?
Oh, yeah. One of the great new developments we've got going on with the Robotech live action film project is we are working with the development team from 300, you know, which is best performing, you know, comic book adaptation movies, you know, on the screen. And we're really happy to be working with them right now on the live action adaptation of Robotech. And also, we've got a whole bunch of licensing opening up for 30th anniversary product coming out this year. So we really look forward to all the cool stuff that we've got coming out for fans.
All right. Well, I want to thank you, Tommy, and I want to thank Elmer for joining me on Let's Voltron, the official Voltron podcast.
And thank you.
Hey, thank you, Mark.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh, so, Mark, just one additional question. Where are you based out of?
I'm based out of Quakertown, Pennsylvania, which is about 35 miles north of Philly.
You know, this is actually a small world because Bill Spangler, the writer who also worked very hard with us on the Robotech Voltron series, he's also based out of Quakertown.
No way.
No. So
really?
You guys are practically neighbors.
Wow, that is so cool. That's cool.
Yeah, you know what? You should, in fact, you shouldn't even be doing the Skype thing. You should go meet him for lunch.
Yeah, I could probably do that.
Okay, you know what? I'll make sure to add in an introduction for you guys and, see if you can do roll in something in there. And actually, he also has a long pedigree in Robotech Comics. He had worked on Robotech Comics long before I ever had.
Wow.
So I hold him in very high regard in terms of his work in the comics industry.
Well, that is totally cool. Thank you. I had no idea.
All right, cool. Well, I hope that answered all your Voltron questions as a Voltron fan.
Yes, it definitely did. And Elmer, we look forward to seeing any more of your work. Do you want to say what you're working on right now?
Well, I can't really say what I'm working on right now, but...
okay.
I might get in trouble, but...
Oh, okay.
Yeah, but the only other Robotech product that I've worked on was Robotech Tactics under Soda Pop and Ninja Division. It's a tabletop game, a miniatures game, so I had a hand in some of the designs for sculpting. So
we'll continue to be looking for your stuff out on DeviantArt.
Yeah, okay. Please check out my stuff.
Okay. Thank you very much, guys, and we'll see you next time on
Let's Voltron.